Normally when we've started, today's going to be a little bit different than we've been doing in the past. Everybody has done some singing. And after yesterday's session, Matt came up and said, "Can I share a song with you?" And I invited him to share it with all of us. And I don't know whether you want to teach it for us to sing.
I think I want to try and teach it.
Sweet.
Yeah.
That would be
okay. Lovely. So this is a song that I wrote when I was preaching on these scriptures that we're working with in this study. And maybe that's all I'll say, because we're going to sing a song now. And so there are two parts. It's a kind of an unfinished song because my imagination is that eventually they'll go together, like over each other. But I don't think I have the kinks worked out. So we're just going to sing it like there's two parts. And it goes like this. Push, pull, push, pull. Push, pull till we make it through. So that's the first part. So the words are just push, pull, push, pull, push, pull till we make it through. So I'll sing that and then you sing it back to me. So push, pull, push, pull, push, pull till we make it through. Push, pull. Push, pull, push, pull till we make it through. Let's sing it again. Push, pull, push, pull, push, pull till we make it through. And then the other part goes, in the middle is grace, grace, grace. In the middle is healing. In the middle is love, love, love. In the Lord, in the middle is grace, grace, grace. In the middle is healing. In the middle is love, love, love. In the Lord, in the middle. So it's in the middle is grace, grace, grace. In the middle is healing. In the middle is love, love, love. In the Lord. So, in the middle is grace, grace, grace. In the middle is healing. In the middle is love, 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 in the Lord. In the middle is grace, grace, grace. In the middle is healing. In the middle is love, 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 in the Lord.
Let's try the other part again.
Push, pull, push, pull, push, pull till we make it through. In the middle is grace, grace, grace. In the middle is healing. In the middle is love, love, love. In the Lord.
So, an unfinished song, but thank you for experimenting with me.
Yay. Thank you for sharing and leading and inviting. So, as we look at this passage, we're coming at it each day of the week from a different perspective and a different angle. And what we're looking at mostly today is issues of religion and faith tradition. And while on other occasions we've looked at the historical context, we're looking a lot more at how do Christians read this story today, and specifically, how do Christians in a time and with a history of, I think what we can rightly call Christian imperialism, read stories about other faith traditions with integrity, with our own integrity and respect for the integrity of diverse traditions. The four kind of interpretive keys that we're using to look at the texts were introduced to me by an anti-racism trainer, but work and apply for all kinds of isms. And so these four I's of isms are that they occur at the interpersonal level, that is, between individuals, that they are ideological, that there are ideas behind racism, behind sexism, behind homophobia, that they are institutional, that there are structures that uphold power imbalance, and that they are internalized, that members of target groups, you know, raised in a toxic atmosphere can't help but take in those messages. And that for the most part, we keep sort of, it's easiest to identify the interpersonal. And a whole lot of the time, personal experiences that people shared, we kind of feel like we pass or fail on the interpersonal. And because those are the easiest to identify, we might say and think, you know, I would never say a racist thing, or I would never say a sexist thing, and judge ourselves and evaluate what we do at the interpersonal level. So I'm not a racist because I would never say fill in the blank. But if I uphold and don't challenge the ideology, if I don't challenge the institutions, and I'm not an ally in overcoming and changing what people have internalized, then only one of those four pillars that holds up racism has been challenged at all. So we're going to be looking at these, and they operate in the text and in our lives. Yes?
I'm sorry. Would it be just redundant to read through the passages? Am I the only one who hasn't read it?
We're going to read through them.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah,
okay,
no worries. I'm doing a little ground setting, and we're totally going to. Because people keep coming in, and because we keep reading. You can't tell what the story is just by knowing them?
I forgot.
There are a few people who can do that, but I'm not sure not one of them. Like occasionally, Wes, who's here, will be having a conversation, and he'll say, you know, Luke 7:14. I'm like, yes, say more about that. So for sure, we're going to read through those passages. Before we do, the way we're going to structure the conversation today is we're going to talk a little bit about Judaism, and then we're going to talk a little bit about Christian evangelism of people of other faith traditions. So a long time ago now, I saw a kind of cheesy made-for-television movie that a moment of which really struck me. It was a story about Jewish children who, during the Second World War, had been hidden in orphanages in France. And sort of the part of the story is interplay between a couple of kids and a Christian boy in the orphanage who's not getting along well with the Jewish kids. And the climactic scene is when the Nazis come and are looking for Jewish children in the orphanage. And it's Christmas Eve, and all of the children are performing a pageant, the story of the birth of Jesus. And after they interrogate the nuns who run the orphanage, then they start to interrogate the children. And they come to this boy who's had a pretty hostile relationship with the new kids who came, and they say, "Are there any Jews here?" And this little boy points to everyone in the Christmas pageant. He points to Mary and to Joseph and to Jesus. And he says, "He's a Jew and she's a Jew and the baby Jesus is a Jew." And I thought that was a particularly, even in a cheesy movie, powerful moment. And I contrast this story with the not made for TV, but real life story of Rabbi Isaac Herzog, who I believe he was, I'm not certain, I believe that he was living in the United States and he was a European Jew who escaped from Europe. And after the Second World War, after many Jewish children had been taken into orphanages, some of which were church-run, some of which were lay-run, many of which were Catholic-run, went looking for those children whose parents had died. whose parents had been killed. And frequently, when he would go to the orphanages and when he would go to politicians and when he would go to church leaders saying, I'm looking for these children, people would deny that they were there. Well, there aren't any Jewish children here. All of the children here are Christians. And so it was, you know, children who had lost their families, who had lost everything, were also being institutionally having their religious identity taken and obscured. And what he would do is he would visit the orphanages, and some people would say, yes, this kid and this kid, and he would work on reuniting them with their Jewish community and finding adoptive parents and reconnecting them with their families. But what he would do if they said there are no Jewish children here, then he would ask if he could see the children, and then if he could speak to the children before bedtime. And the one of the most fundamental Jewish prayers is the Shema, the Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Shema Israel, Adonai Elohim, Adonai Echad. And it's a Hebrew prayer that often mothers would teach their children at bedtime. And that it's a call and response. And he would go in the evening to the orphanage, and he would begin the first part of the Shema. And the Hebrew word hear is also, Shema is also to do. And so there's both listen and act. In that, and he would go in and he would say, Shema Israel, and the children, the Jewish children who had been raised by Jewish mothers would respond, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And the notion of that, like, persistent dedication of someone who's really looking for you and for who you are and to connect you with what is vital to you. This, I thought, kind of an amazing counter story to the other. So, with those two stories in mind, we're gonna read Matthew 15, 10 to 20. And we'll do, for those of you who've been here before, like we've been doing, is just read it a verse at a time, and we'll go around. I don't think there's 20 of us, so some of us will read twice. And we'll read through the whole thing twice. When you're not reading, try and not examine the text too much, but listen to the words. 10 to 20 connects with the main part of the story that we've been reading to this point, the story about Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman, a woman who comes and begs Jesus to heal her daughter. The disciples keep them apart, and she persists. Jesus says, I've come to the lost sheep, to the children of Israel, and she persists, and he says, is it right to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs? And she says, even the dogs eat the crumbs under the table. So that's the main story that we've been unpacking all week long. And so we're looking a little bit now at kind of the literary context of the story, how it fits in to the broader story. So I'm going to start 15:10, and we'll just go around, and if you lose your place, ask the person next to you, and we'll try and go through it twice. So if you read verse 20, pause, and then someone else will start again at verse 10. Then he called the crowd to him and said to them, listen and understand.
It is not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but it is what comes out of the mouth that defiles.
Then the disciples approached and said to him, do you know that the Pharisees took offense when they heard what you said?
He answered, "Every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted will be uprooted."
Let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind. And if one blind person guides another, both will fall into a pit.
But Peter said to him, "Explain this parable to us."
Then he said, "Are you also still without understanding?
Do you not see whatever goes into the mouth passes into the stomach, and so passes on?
But what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this is what defiles.
For out of the heart come evil intentions, murder, adultery, fornication, theft, false witness, slander.
These are what defile a person, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile."
Maybe I'll read it through so that everybody else has a chance to listen. That's the way to go. Then he called the crowd to him and said to them, "Listen and understand. It is not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but it is what comes out of the mouth that defiles." Then the disciples approached and said to him, "Do you know that the Pharisees took offense when they heard what you said?" He answered, "Every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted will be uprooted. Let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind. If one blind person guides another, both will fall into a pit." But Peter said to him, "Explain this parable to us." Then he said, "Are you also still without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into the mouth enters the stomach and goes out into the sewer? But what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this is what defiles. For out of the heart come evil intentions, murder, adultery, fornication, theft, false witness, and slander. These are what defile a person, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile." What we're going to do next is we're going to read this same text in tandem with the story about the Syrophoenician woman, the story that we've been examining through the week. And I'm just going to ask Gina and Matt if they would be the two voices to read this piece. You can kind of lean over and look. And the two passages come consecutively and kind of comment on one another. But the way I've laid them out is to kind of to intersperse them so that we can hear the voices reflecting back and forth. Is that text?
Yep.
Do you see this for you? All right. So it doesn't matter who starts. And just
go back and forth.
Yeah.
Then he called the crowd to him and said to them, "Listen and understand. It is not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but it is what comes out of the mouth that defiles."
Jesus left that place and went away to the district of Tyre and Sidon. Just then a Canaanite woman from that region came out and started shouting, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon." But he did not answer her at all.
Then the disciples approached and said to him, "Do you know that the Pharisees took offense when they heard what you said?" He answered, "Every plant that my heavenly Father has planted will be uprooted. Let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind. And if one blind person guides another, both will fall into a pit."
And his disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she keeps shouting after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." He answered, "It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs."
But Peter said to him, "Explain this parable to us." Then he said, "Are you also still without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into the mouth enters the stomach and goes out into the sewer? But what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this is what defiles. For out of the heart come evil intentions, murder, adultery, fornication, theft, false witness, slander. These are what defile a person. But to eat with unwashed hands does not defile.
She said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered her, "Woman, great is your faith. Let it be done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed instantly.
So stories about religious leaders, stories about a purity code, stories about what's on the inside and what's on the outside, and who's an insider and who's an outsider. What do you notice? What do you think?
Well, it sounds like Jesus is kind of turning upside down what the community has internalized, institutionalized, ideologicalized. He's challenging kind of their whole way of approaching their faith.
In the first section or in both?
I think in both.
In the Matthew story, he's directly contradicting just sort of the external rituals that the Pharisees are promoting and upholding, with the hand washing and all these things that really don't make a difference in the long run and getting to the true heart of your faith and your how you treat other people. And I guess in the Mark story too, where he's taking this Canaanite woman who's rejected and responding to her call and her.
Other comments or observations, Judy?
It's just really an extension of that it's what came out of her mouth that caused him to stop and say, "This is good.
Mm-hmm.
This is what's right."
And in the Mark version of the story, because there's both Mark and Matthew tell the story of the Syrophoenician woman, and they tell it in slightly different ways. And both Mark and Matthew have a preceding story about clean and unclean and about this controversy with the Pharisees. That in Mark, what it doesn't say, your faith is great. What it says is, because of what you have said, because of what has come out of your mouth, your daughter is healed. It's very easy when Christians read this story, or it's sort of an easy default to go into to read this story and to forget what the children in the first story today told us, that Jesus is a Jew. That, in fact, in this story, the only person who's clearly not a Jew is the Syrophoenician woman. And so that this is not a Jews versus Christians story. Christianity isn't invented yet. This is a very Jewish controversy. And so that the breadth and difference and texture of what first century Judaism is quite broad. That there are people who have that super narrow legal, it's about clean and unclean. And it's not just clean and unclean food, but this unclean woman who's a foreigner, whose daughter has an unclean spirit. And she's a woman, and so it's all this layering of uncleanliness, but she's the person who comes in and makes this great inbreaking.
And I noticed in Mark 2, it identifies her as a Gentile.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is a valid way to read it, but one of the things that occurs to me looking at the two things laid next to each other is I think about myself in roles of leadership where I'm teaching something, and it's really clear to me when I'm teaching it. And then I get into the push and pull of actual interaction, and I forget myself, or I go back to my default training. And so it's like he makes this very strong argument that overturns the purity code of Judaism. And then he's just going about his life. And this woman comes along and says, heal my daughter. And he says, but you're not of the chosen people. Which is, it makes me feel some sympathy for myself because I know that I do that too. It can be really easy when I'm making a presentation about some topic to say, well, here's the way it needs to be. But then undoing the internalized aspects of the what I inherited from my culture, it's often a lot more challenging, actually, when I'm interacting. So I don't know if that's a way to read it, that it's like he was clear in his teaching, and then he was working it out in the relationship.
Well, I think that's very something that I've experienced in the last several years, is that it's easier to get it in my head and understand how I want to perceive things in my head. But like you say, it takes a lot longer for your whole body, all of your actions, to reflect what you know is the right way to be. When you've been doing it this other way for so many years, your head gets there before the rest of you kind of has to work to catch up to that.
I think Matt also points out, like, something I've neglected in this conversation, is that that what's internalized isn't only members of a target population who internalize the bad message, but that members of dominant population internalize the message of false superiority, and that unpacking both ends of those. In both passages, Jesus says things that are really offensive.
Yeah.
And it's easier for us to recognize that he's being offensive to the Canaanite woman. And it's more difficult for us to recognize that he's being offensive to the Pharisees. That we're more used to that model or that kind of paradigm. And within Judaism of the first century, not a lot of people were able financially, socially, physical location to maintain the purity codes. And so this is a critique, and it's a mighty strong critique. I like to teach and talk about this passage because this is a passage where Jesus talks about poop. And I like to tell kids that in the Bible, Jesus talks about poop. He says, what goes in you, goes in your mouth, goes right out into the sewer. And I don't think it takes much of a paraphrase to say that purity codes that exclude and that the majority of the population are prevented by gender, by economic status in participating in, that people are separated from God because of these codes, are crap. And then the next paragraph, figure out how to act that out in real life.
Every time I read this, I get caught up in that one verse about the blind leading the blind.
Mm-hmm.
And it amazes me when I sit with other able-bodied persons, how they don't get caught there. And I'm the only one, like, I feel like when I sit and read this with other people, I'm the only one who gets stuck right in the middle of what offends the Pharisees. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, we know. And they just keep on going. And I'm like, wait. You know, I'm thinking if I were blind and I were reading this, I'd be pissed off there and I wouldn't make it any further. You know, I would be so mad that, you know, just because I can't see, I can't lead other people? Well, no, I work around what prevents me from living and how, you know, how suddenly I'm stuck there.
And if you've been anywhere near a blind school, there are blind people leading the blind
all
over the place.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and
we're
going
to talk a lot about ableism and disability
okay.
And ability, and that's totally tomorrow's focus,
okay,
which doesn't mean you can't talk about it
now. But,
it comes around at the end of the passage as well. It's like this is a healing story, and the person who is healed is off stage, and her mother wants her different.
Yeah.
On the first day that we read this passage, one of the folks who was in the class, who I'm not sure if he is still in the village or not, pointed out the fact that this is kind of a hinge in Matthew where the story goes from Jesus and where the story leaves the Jewish context. And this woman challenges Jesus to say, no, the love and the healing power of God is for everyone. And that many people have sort of the history of Christian interpretation of this passage is, and that's the switch to the conversion and the mission to the Gentiles, because the Jews have rejected Jesus. And so that's a really fraught kind of hinge, and I want to move to talking a little bit more about that, and I'm going to bring in South Asian theologian who has edited a number of fantastic anthologies about developing world biblical interpretation, who in personal conversation from sort of one degree of separation goes by Suji, but his name is Suji Ratajra. And I may be mispronouncing. Here's what he says about this story. One tends to see any Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist, or Sikh as a potential target for evangelization and absorption into the Christian community. While on the other hand, Judaism is a dead letter, awash with legalism and ritualism. The problem with this ecclesiocentric church at the center, Christian-centered, reading of this story is that it deters any meaningful dialogue with members of other faiths. And maybe I'll go from there into a little quote. We read yesterday a bit from Kwok Pui Lan. She has done this fantastic book called Discovering the Bible in the Non-Biblical World. And it's a collection of short essays around the theme of reading the Bible in an interfaith context with an interfaith commitment and understanding. Mm. And so she quotes here from a group sermon done by a group of Asian feminist theologians. Who? Jesus? Who is this Jesus? Is this Jesus that the rich worship? In the name of whom the powerful nations convert the world? Is it not true that the disciples chased the Canaanite woman away? Asian women have met another Jesus. They have found the Messiah among the Minjung, the rejected. There, at the corner of the street, in the prison cell, in the vast exploited land, and in the people who never lose hope. But the Canaanite woman must have found the same poor, lowly, and ragged Jesus. So this is a story that's often read as a conversion story. But I don't think there's a lot of evidence in the text that the woman is converted. So I'm curious about what other people notice and think.
It amazes me at her boldness to come meet this Jewish person she's heard about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that in itself, for her to cross those many barriers and boundaries to even approach him, whether it's in the Markan text in a closed home or in the Lucan text and just out in the open. Just, I mean, you know, she was desperate and determined.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really am amazed and wonder at that drive that she has.
We talked a lot in the second session about the issues of borders,
mm-hmm.
and how sort of reading national borders helps us read this text as well.
Yeah.
One thing I don't have the passage in front of me, but she had never heard him herself. She had only heard about him,
mm-hmm.
and still had heard enough that she believed.
Mm-hmm. She also comes in, she's like clearly set up as this outsider. In Matthew, they like go physically to, you know, they're in the borderlands. In Mark, she is from somewhere else. So she's clearly set up as an outsider, as the other, as a Canaanite. At the same time, she's totally speaking insider language. She's using these Jewish titles. And so there's... again, there's sort of the who really gets it, and who's really in and who's really out, and you know, what nourishes, because it's all, again, a story, it's interlocking stories of bread, and what goes out into the sewer.
Does she see him as a Jew or as someone really different?
I think in the Matthew story, that they are definitely set up as kind of Canaanite and Jew. I don't know. How do you imagine that she sees? Because that's one of the things we talked about as well in texts that often women aren't subjects of the text; they're often objects.
Would it make any difference to her? Maybe she doesn't give a darn. She heard that he can heal, so she's going to go to him. She probably doesn't. Maybe she doesn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's our own.
Mm-hmm.
As Christians, we put that into the own.
A kind of a similar but reverse observation of that. Judith Plasko, who is a Jewish feminist scholar, she talks about when she teaches that Christians are always, you know, disbelieving and surprised that Jews actually don't care that much about Jesus. It's not like they're busy rejecting him. It's that there are many other theological issues that are live and important for them. And so when the power is flipped, when we're, you know, currently in a situation and have a history where Christians have been able to control a whole lot of other people's religious practice, that when the power situation is flipped, does that identity matter? So, but since you asked the question, I'm curious, what do you think? How do you imagine that she saw Jesus?
Well, I think that she had probably heard that here was a person who could heal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It occurs to me, you know, if I can go way back to your story about the Nazis coming in to find the Christmas, you know, to the
mm-hmm.
Christmas program you
yep.
put on, and the little boy said, she's a Jew, he's a Jew, and he's a Jew. Well, if they had known their history, they were Jews because they weren't Christians yet.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that wasn't the point of the story, was it? The point
no,
of
that was the point of the story, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was not telling the Nazis who the Jewish children were, but affirming the Jewish identity.
Okay.
of those Jesus and Joseph and Mary in the story.
I wonder as well about your earlier comment about her using Jewish language and whether that was considering the role that we talked about yesterday of women in the Bible and purpose and kind of their not full characterization compared to others. Whether those words were put into her mouth, whether she did come seeking but didn't use that language because she might not have known it.
I think if there's a historical core to the story, I don't know that, you know, at the time of the story, I don't think that the, you know, the kingdom movement was using that language necessarily.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, so Jew or non-Jew, kingdom
right.
movement person or not, I don't think that was the language. So
exactly.
So there's kind of multiple layers
right.
of...
Yeah.
You know, we have to get this lined up with the language that we're using at the time that the story was written.
Right.
So, yeah, I doubt it.
This last verse in, or 20, in Matthew about the, these are what defile a person, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile, because they had such an important part of their lives and their religion to wash physically and everything, but I'm not quite clear on what Jesus, you know, besides they did use this spiritually, didn't they? I mean,
can you say more about
I'm
what you mean by using it spiritually?
This. Pardon?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you meant when you said use it spiritually.
Did they? I mean, is that what part of their cleansing and washing was about?
I think so. I think that you know, first century Judaism is as complicated as Christianity in this century.
Because Jesus is saying unwashed hands.
What do Christians think about gay marriage?
Depends on the yeah.
Yeah. So what do first century Jews think about hand washing?
It was extremely important.
To all of them?
Pardon?
To all of them?
I thought so.
See, I think those are parallel questions. I think any question, what do Christians think about the meaning of bread in liturgical celebration? Is as broad a question as what do first century Jews think about washing hands?
We don't know.
That
we
Jesus
don't
thought
know.
Jesus as a first century Jew thought it's not important. That the Pharisees as first century Jews thought it's essential. It defines whether you're in or out. That, you know, a vast peasant population thought, you know, it'd be nice if I was able to meet those rules that I'm told are important. So a broad, diverse, complicated, like nothing that Jesus said or did wasn't Jewish. Jesus wasn't in the business of inventing Christianity. Jesus represents part of the broad tradition of Judaism at the time.
See, this is what I need to know, is because I narrow it down too much and I need to be able to see the bigger picture, and that's why I asked that.
Yeah, and Christians are super good at imagining all the good stuff is Jesus and Christian, and all the bad stuff is Jewish. And to just keep like highlighting that difference and forgetting all the good stuff was Jewish stuff. And was deeply rooted in tradition.
Wouldn't that be considered almost like circumcision? I mean, they really thought that was what you had to do, and Jesus says you didn't have to be circumcised. to follow him.
I think that that was a conversation after Jesus,
that was
an early church issue of really, like, yeah. So this is one of the stories about that shift from a minority Jewish renewal movement to embrace more than just Jews and working that out in a context where there were, you know, where the kingdom movement was a minority. Judaism is a minority in the Roman Empire. And what Jews are especially known for is not mixing, of keeping their boundaries both physical, ritual, and social very high. And in the Greek and Roman world, it's just polite to worship other people's gods. And so when the early church, when the kingdom movement began to move beyond Judaism, that was a huge controversy and a very, very complicated thing to work out, because it was both a resistance movement to Jewish collaboration with Rome and to Rome, and to say, we're not only going to do this as Jews, and to retain that resistance to empire was a really complicated thing to work out.
In the two stories, I'm sorry, I might have missed this before, but the difference that what I get out of Matthew and Mark just is the description of the woman.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew, from what I remember, Matthew sort of addresses a Jewish audience. So to me, it's like the terms he uses kind of are Jewish terms to describe her, and they sound harsher to me, whereas Mark, who's actually an earlier writer, is more broad, and the words don't seem as harsh, you know. He just says she's a Gentile, and it doesn't seem as harsh to me as saying she's a Canaanite. And so I think it fits with what you were just saying. It is trying to do the switch, and Matthew's trying to do it gently to the Jews by using some of their terminology, and Mark is broader in addressing a larger audience.
Yeah, I agree that Matthew kind of like takes some of what's a bit latent in Mark and really highlights especially those insider, outsider, Jew, Gentile issues.
For me, what we're exploring about the reminder of Jesus in making statements responding to the Pharisees, or this whole passage from 10 to 20, that he was a Jew speaking about Jewish practice, and then thinking about that in my own context, to me, it's actually more empowering to think, and so I, in following Jesus, am called to reflect on my own tradition and speak that powerfully. And, you know, and the ways that I might get tripped up by fear when someone says, well, do you know what the conservatives in the church, that they took offense when they heard what you said? And he even launches into it even more. You know, yeah, well, everything that God planted will flourish, and everything God didn't plant is going to be uprooted. Like, he doesn't shrink back when someone's, you know, the gossip about him says, oh, people don't like what you're saying. He's like, yeah, right on. Like, let me tell you a little bit more clearly what I'm talking about. And he's talking to his own people, which somehow is, like, even more empowering to me than he's being a Christian over here talking about the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, because that's riskier. It's like all this tribal, relational, cultural, like, that's my people that I'm talking about.
Yeah, for sure the thing that, like, in challenge of power stuff and trying to speak my own perspective and work for justice on that, the stuff that pushes my buttons is when I feel or hear that people who also identify as Christian judge what I've said and take offense at. So that is a powerful nexus. The other issue that Puilan raises, and also some indigenous readers have raised, is the issue around heathens and demons mm-hmm. being frequently equated. Mm-hmm. And that that in Christian imperialism, and that in a whole lot of people's stories of what Christianity brought them, it was identifying them as heathens and demons.
What is that book, the title of the book?
Puilan's book? It is called Discovering the Bible in the Non-Biblical World.
Okay.
And it's available from Orbis Publisher.
Could you spell the name?
Sorry?
Please, could you spell the name?
Her surname, which appears first, is Kwok, K-W-O-K, and her first name is Puilan, P-U-I-L-A-N.
P-U-I?
Mm-hmm. -L-A-N.
Discovering the Bible in...
the non-biblical world.
That sounds like a good book club.
It could be a very good book club read, because they're pretty short chapters, and it's deceptive the how deep and how much they are. I'm just going to close by reading her those two pieces of poetry from the sermon. And tomorrow we're going to focus on issues of ableism, ability, disability. And we're going to use some work from Rabbi Julia Watts Bessler, who is a woman rabbi who is a wheelchair user. Uses a wheelchair to get around.
Oh, awesome.
And has written some really great stuff on this, and who I just wanted to say her name, having used a lot of her work today. Who? Jesus? Who is this Jesus? Is this Jesus that the rich worship? In the name of whom the powerful nations convert the world? Is it not true that the disciples chased the Canaanite woman away? Asian women have met another Jesus. They have found the Messiah among the Minjung, the rejected. There, the corner of the street, in the prison cell, in the vast exploited land, and in the people who never lose hope. The Canaanite woman must have found the same poor, lowly, and ragged Jesus. But who is this Canaanite woman? She is the woman down on the dirty road of Calcutta. She is the mother of a political prisoner in Seoul. She is the old garment factory worker in Hong Kong. She is the mother whose daughter is a prostitute in Jakarta, Taipei, or Chiang Mai. She is also the survivor from Hiroshima. The woman is the poorest among the poor, the oppressed among the oppressed. She is at every corner of Asia, and she fills the third world.